Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Hello, and thanks again for listening to another episode of All Better. I'm your host, Joe Van Wee. Today's guest is my friend Evan Glass. Evan is the owner and operator of Mac Tools in northeastern Pennsylvania. Evan moved here in 2001 to get sober, and he's lived here ever since. Today we get to talk about the last 20 years of what sobriety looked like for him, what a relapse looked like after long-term sobriety, some of the problems that rise up for an individual in long-term sobriety, especially someone who is a caretaker of many, and when crisis rises in your life, who do you approach to speak openly and candidly about the help you may need? We talk about that in great detail. And we also talk about the many dozens of people that we know that have been here for the last 20 years and moved here from somewhere else to escape addiction and find recovery, and what they added to our community here in Scranton. Let's meet Evan Glass.
Racism doesn't exist.
Well, we were just finishing up a conversation. We got a hot mic now.
Oh, great.
So again, I want to thank Evan. Evan and I have been friends, I would say, geez, it's got to be 20, 25 years since 97.
I moved here in 2000.
Okay, 2000. Oh, wow. Okay, now I remember. ICC. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, so we've been friends since 2000.
Yep.
Yeah, it's 23 years. And Evan stopped by today because Evan, I'm going to let him tell his story. He's one of these interesting stories that he moves here, and immerses himself in a recovery community. And he's now a Scrantonian with a flourishing business. And this story's common, and it's not as linear as, you know, most people would like to be when it concerns recovery and building a business. But Evan has a very interesting story. And a friend, and I thought we could just shoot the breeze today. I was going to start with this, Evan. Hold on.
That's amazing. I have that picture.
All right. Well, it just always ends up on my desk. This is a picture of my brother, Evan, and myself, almost looking like the Beastie Boys. This was Evan, New Year's Eve dance. I would say that was 2010.
Mm-hmm. The red fat laces and the Adidas.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great picture. So, Evan, where are you from originally? Where were you born?
I grew up in Pleasantville, New York.
Pleasantville, New York.
Yep, just north of the suburbs of New York City.
Okay. And how would you describe Pleasantville for someone who wasn't familiar with it?
Oh, it's beautiful there. It's great.
Yep. Remember that movie, Pleasantville?
Yeah. It's everybody's in black and white.
Yeah. I forgot about that movie. That was a late 90s flick. So just summarize, what was it like growing up there? How long was your entire childhood in Pleasantville?
Yeah. So I grew up in like a Frank Lloyd Wright community. So lots of yuppies, and my mother was, you know, very liberal, and I was on my bike, you know, every day and did what I wanted. You know, I didn't have... That was the days of no helmets.
And, yeah.
You know, you went outside and played in the creek all day.
And did you have any friends, like, as you started to reach adolescence, maybe from the boroughs,
Of course. And the kids from the other sides of the tracks.
Yeah.
And yeah. I fit in with them better.
And so where did you, when did you realize you fit in with kids that maybe it didn't have the same advantages of what might've been in your proximity, your eye line? How did you connect with those?
Well, kids? I'm a product of a single mother.
Yeah.
So I instantly related with other kids that had the same behavioral issues, you know, that I had, you know what I mean? That's,
and this is pre alcohol, pre cigarettes, like something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what would you describe it as? Like, what was happening?
I was also shunned too by the kids, their parents, you know, of the good, you know, dynamic households, yeah. You know, the parents that don't be friends with Evan.
And how old are you when this is like, cause that sucks, man. That is just so boxing. It boxes a kid. And
even 8 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He's a bad boy.
Yeah. Right from the gate.
So did you feel an angst? Maybe how would you describe the way you felt before you ever got drunk or maybe experienced your first joint? What was a feeling that was always there that maybe wasn't as noticeable until you were relieved of it?
Well, of course, the way I communicated with myself, learning disabilities, attention disorders. So I was always had, you know, and then I was a daydreamer. Like, so I didn't pay attention because I was, you know, getting kicked in the face with the soccer ball because I was picking dandelions out of the soccer field, you know? So, you know, right away, my voice to myself was, you're no good.
Yeah.
You know, and there's just lots of insecurities as a child.
Yeah. It's freakish. You end up, you know, somewhere when you're an adult, you're in a room, there's 50 people here. It would just describe the same exact childhood. And you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, I thought I was suffering from this quietly. I didn't know other people thought this way. It's like,
but then it makes like a savant situation where my other abilities were brighter.
Yeah.
You know, so I developed skills that other kids didn't have.
And what would be some of them? Because I know what they are. What would you describe them?
I was just motivated to earn.
Yeah.
You know, and I was the man of the house. Like, I felt like I even had to provide and, you know.
Evan, I don't know this. Did you have any siblings?
None.
So only, it's you and your mom.
And my mom's an only child.
And is she working full time or you just started? When did
she's
you put
an
the
artist.
Hustle on? She's an artist.
You know? So, it, you know, she was a stay at home mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the hustle just woke up in you early.
Right away.
You've always been an entrepreneur. I've never seen.
My mother would take me shopping at the secondhand store.
Yeah.
So the toys I got were used, older toys, Lincoln Logs, Erector sets. I loved Erector sets. Old trains, you know.
American Pickers, man.
You know, like, so I had to make my own entertainment while other kids were given something that functioned.
When did you know you could profit from something that was something else? Somebody didn't want this.
I always tell this story. Boys Life magazine. Did you ever see that?
Yeah. Like as a punchline, I remember Ranger Rick, but Boys Life, I know what it is.
So it was a magazine for the purpose of Boy Scouts.
Okay.
And on the back of it was the American Sales Club. And so you would sell stationery door to door and you would earn a toy. They didn't give the kids cash.
Wow.
So I would go, I signed up for this thing and I would knock on doors with like their portfolio. It was almost like, what was that years ago? There was another like thing.
There was always candy magazine drives. I remember those. There was drives,
right.
And you had the catalogs. You could sell things like.
So door to door. And I was charming and cute. So people were like, all right, I'll give you $15 for some stationery. Like people used the mail system back then.
Yeah.
Still. I'm a product of the 70s. So I wanted a telescope, man. You know, so I earned two of them. And then the pallet arrived in the driveway. And this is like where alcoholism and my behavior reared its head is I've got the toy. I did the job. the pallet arrives with all of my customer stationery, and now my mother has to put it in her Chevy Citation and deliver it for me because I was already gratified.
How old are you?
God, I must have been 10 or 11.
Well, this kind of entrepreneurial, you've already commandeered your mother as an extension of your corporation. She will do the your sales. Oh my God, you had Amazon.
Yeah.
That is exactly. Amazon. And that stayed with you. That never really left.
Never.
Never. I've always was inspired, and I've learned a lot from you. When we first met, I couldn't believe, you know, you just entered recovery and you're already establishing yourself pretty quickly in Scranton through property, business drive, skills. And I was just, it was inspiring to a lot of people because we were similar in age. And you paved the way for a lot of people in their 20s. This is 20 years ago to think they could own a home. It's great in Scranton that are in recovery. That's a powerful thing to see. In a recovery community, especially in people in their
20s. I think I was 30 when I bought my house.
30? So. Yeah, I'm already off by a couple of years, but I think you get what I'm laying down. That was real.
But like I fixed my credit.
Yeah.
You know, I went into work every day.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Joe Van Wee. I'm the host of All Better, but I'm also the CEO of Fellowship House. At Fellowship House, we believe long-term recovery requires a personality change as well as a clinical intervention. These ideas can take several months to achieve. Our philosophy is to provide a safe, therapeutic, and exceedingly active environment for patients to achieve these personality changes and find joy in the fellowship of recovery, which will allow for long-term sobriety. We believe that recovery extends beyond treatment and peer-to-peer communities into real life. In Fellowship House, we provide a design for living that focuses on education and service. We have strong relationships with the 12 universities and vocational schools in the area and ensure that our fellows pursue their personal goals while entering sobriety. We also stress independence and responsibility, making sure each individual is financially solid and self, and helping to make their community a better place. As a treatment center, Fellowship House offers both residential and outpatient treatment services to individuals and families affected by addiction and alcoholism. We're a DDAP licensed provider of general outpatient, intensive outpatient, and partial hospitalization programming, as well as a level of care assessments. If you want to find out more information about Fellowship House, please visit fellowshiphouses.com. Well, before we get there, I want to talk about that because that's a hard thing. You don't always have someone to navigate you through that. And a lot of people need that kind of help, coaching. Maybe we could talk about that, but what was it? About what was the first time you got high or drunk? What were you doing?
I was at a family meal and I had a stepfather at the time and he thought it would be humorous. But I mean, before I got drunk with alcohol, I mean, there was other, you know, I would go to into the garage when I was little and take the cap off the lawnmower.
Oh, take it.
Yeah, I like the way it smelled, but it's...
Yeah, I know that smell.
You know, I mean, there was that. But the first alcohol that touched these lips was at a family meal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I was cracking jokes and I'm like, wow, everybody likes me.
Yeah. Wow. So it immediately had a profound effect on you, the way you felt about yourself and how you interacted with people.
Yeah.
And that you never experienced that kind of fluid social movement, even in your own home prior to that.
And then later on, then it happened again in like middle school where, I must've been 12 or 13 where we stole a bottle of vodka from somebody's parents and we got drunk and then sick.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, the story on Monday back at school attracted people.
Yeah.
This adventure. I was like, oh, this is my identity.
a boy's life.
You know, I've arrived.
And this progressed pretty quickly for a young guy. Mm-hmm. How would you describe that? How did it turn dark so quickly?
It didn't. I don't know if it was quick.
Well, you were in your 20s. That's pretty quick for most people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'm a high school dropout.
Okay.
So I was a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And alcohol didn't sit right with me. I was 90 pounds. Like, I was lightweight. Like, I was the kid that, you know, I'd go to the party, drink 3 beers, pass out on your couch, and then urinate on it. Like, yeah. I couldn't hold the liquor. But marijuana, I loved it. You know, yeah. That was my title in life. And of course, you know, 1994, Cypress Hill, the Wu-Tang Clan, like those were my mentors. I wanted to be.
It's a culture, and it was, there's a unifying poetry to all of it.
Absolutely.
And there's activism to it too. Yeah. I mean, that was, I saw Cypress Hill 1992 at Lollapalooza too. And how could you not like Cypress Hill? I mean,
I'm not a big West Coast fan, but if I were to choose, that would be my favorite.
They had an edge of silliness, like
exactly,
yeah. And they just openly talked about smoking marijuana as a mindset, mm-hmm. like it was driving their art form. And marijuana isn't as, you know, abrasive as drinking, especially underage. Drinking's an investment of time. It's hard to hide. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away quickly. You could ease into being stoned. You can manage it throughout a day. You could smoke all day.
Yeah.
Did you smoke all day pretty quickly?
Oh, yeah. And a friend with weed was a friend indeed, you know? So yeah. If I had weed, I had friends.
You had a connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an icebreaker. And I think that's a powerful thing. You know, you can really zero in on if you walk in a room, especially with weed, you can even do this with cocaine, but weed is different. There's a connection that is unsaid. If you share a joint with someone and someone's smoking pot, there's a lot of assumptions quickly being made and the social ice is broken. There's no angst. You could let your hair down and meet someone Absolutely. Quickly.
I think my mother even wasn't as strict with me because she knew it was less dangerous than alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is pre, like if anyone was young, this is pre cards, dispensary.
Yeah.
It's a lot of seeds. There's a lot of branches being picked out of bags. was there ever a time in that time where weed is, you know, this part of your life, you're using it daily, that you experienced a bad high, not like a bad trip, but like a little paranoia. Maybe I smoked.
Of course. Absolutely.
And how would that subside back then? Like, was there an amount you thought you had to take to avoid paranoia? I'm always curious about this because I've been talking about it a lot. They're finally able to research cognitively, like what's happening. Why do certain people experience relaxation with certain strands mm-hmm. versus maybe a paranoia heightened state that you're taking in too much information socially, cues from eyes, people's movement. It just makes this self-centered paranoia just rise up.
I'm not
up.
Even a fan of weed.
Yeah.
Honestly, like looking yeah. back on it, I'm like, I smoked pot one time in the course of the past 23 years.
Yeah.
And I'm sober 8 years.
Yeah.
I think it's awful.
Yeah.
I've never felt really
relaxing.
No, I've always like been looking out the windows, thinking the cops are coming to get me, questioning. It even brings up some emotional stuff for me. And it's like, you know, after being sober and smoking that one time, I was saying, why am I doing this to everyone? Like, I was really feeling bad.
Like just washed with guilt.
Yeah.
Yeah, pot's really strong. And, you know, I had an awful relapse. Both of us relate mm-hmm. it and connect on this. After being sober for years, and you've experienced this, I smoked. I initially felt relaxed. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't long after that. It was creating tremendous anxiety, but I didn't stop smoking it. I wasn't drinking yet. All I was smoking was weed.
Yeah.
And I was so desperate to change my consciousness, I was willing to induce anxiety because I could just say it was from weed. It wasn't from my thoughts or life. Weed's caught. It was awful.
Absolutely.
And it always felt there was so much.
The heart palpitations I get from weed is worse than cocaine.
Yeah. Yes. I experienced that. So I really didn't like it by the time I drank. And once I drink and use cocaine, I don't smoke weed.
Yeah.
I won't talk, like, I don't even want it in the room.
It's immature.
But I was reading, there's a great, and not reading, listening to a podcast. It's Huberman Labs. And this guy's a Stanford neurologist. And a lot of his podcasts are like 40 minutes. They're like straight lectures. I learned more about weed last year in 40 minutes than I ever knew in my whole entire life. And I smoked a lot of weed.
What'd you learn?
What the paranoia will not leave. If you have the psychology that it just increases and it gets worse. And now weed at this dosage that, you know, you see these.
This is crazy.
It causes psychosis. And I'm not witch hunting weed. I don't care what people like. There's another side
people
of me.
People are going to listen to our podcast and hate us.
Yeah, right? I'm not labeling weed as the devil's lettuce or anything. I'm saying
if you're going to smoke weed, I'd rather you do that than heroin or fentanyl, whatever.
Please. Yeah, there's I've seen people do that as harm reduction. So it's there's a lot of dimensions to this. But just talking specifically you and I having the same experience now that you're saying that, we're guys who can't experience again a nice way to smoke weed.
Yeah,
and this was a fact, and he lays it out. I probably won't do it as elegantly as he does, but he explains it in great detail, and it's been studied in depth now for 7 years because it's legal in some states. These exact ideas of what emotions are coming out in a high, what would cause paranoia, what's the psychological state of someone, especially if they had addiction. And I was sold on it after that. I knew exactly what was happening to me. And it wasn't the weed. The weed was accentuating anxiety I already had.
I feel like I outgrew it.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people. Well, what was your drug that really grabbed you after, you know, most kids have that in the 90s. Guys like us had this exploratory weed thing. But was there something else afterwards that really
With the weed.
Okay.
You know, in the early 90s, I mean, there was LSD, mushrooms. I didn't like either of those very much. But mescaline, I ate a lot of those because it had speed in it.
Wow. I never did mescaline.
And then, you know, cocaine and other narcotics. Yeah. You know.
How about cocaine? You mentioned earlier you had attention deficit disorder and attention problems. The cocaine give you any sense of order?
Absolutely.
In your head?
Yep. I'm an improved performance guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and I won't go so far. And opiates do the same thing for me. Like, give me that energy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not one of those people that nods out. Like,
it's 'cause you're ADD.
I'm productive.
Yeah, that's a common effect.
And people. Also, I'm a great communicator. Like, yes, I can sell stuff to people. Like, I'll convince you. And then, of course, while I'm under the influence now, I'm scared of how people pay. Like, so when somebody's car was broken, I had a comfort zone that I would meet. Like, so after like $1,000 of repair, I would be uncomfortable calling them and be like, your car is really messed up and needs $1,000.
Yeah.
But under the influence of opiates, $3,000, bro, I'll get it done.
Yeah.
You know, like I could just.
And it was a legitimate $3,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's so funny. That is just. Do you think that's because of. Did you have friends when you were young? I'm just. Absolutely. I want to pry that were. Didn't have even less privileges than you or I, that you felt bad ever having more than them.
Yeah.
Isn't that a weird.
Yeah. Well, I feel that way now. People ask me to borrow money sometimes, and I'm like, I don't even have it. I just give it away.
Yeah.
Generosity is a problem for me.
I don't know. You walk a path that your intuition will tell you. I don't think you can only judge that, man. I've seen you help and make a real impact on people's lives that stayed sober even while we both went back out. You've changed.
There's guys out there that I got, not like to take this credit, that are 20 years sober.
Yeah. Yeah, you sponsored dozens of people in early 2000s.
And Leo's kid.
Yeah. And you took to the program so well. Let's back up and like,
well,
let's
it was make punishment.
Let's make an entry into AA. Sure, let's get to 2000, just so I could have this linear narrative of people meeting you and how you arrived in Scranton. Like, how would you start to build up the arrival here? How did that happen? And how old were you?
I was 24 when I went to the Karen Foundation.
Yeah.
And then the Karen Foundation to Serenity Lodge. And then from Serenity Lodge to one of Sober House in downtown Scranton.
And that's when Frank owned Serenity Lodge.
Yeah.
Yep, yeah. I'm Frank.
Two garbage bags full of clothes.
Wow. Yep. And you never heard it? Did you ever hear of Scranton prior to that?
Never. And like when I was at the Karen Foundation, the people were like, "You're going to Serenity Lodge?" And I was like, "Yeah." They're like, "I heard you have to plow the fields up there and pick corn." And I'm like, "If that's what you want me to do," you know, I was beaten.
Yeah, man.
You
know? What got you beaten that quick at 24 that you could feel and accept that you wanted recovery?
I didn't do opiates until I was 19.
Okay.
And, but I was hooked right away. So by 20, in the course of 5 years, 4 years, I was on the methadone program. I was an IV cocaine user. Like, it was unbelievable. Like, people looked at me and like, they were like, "This kid is in bad shape." And I'd been in 5 treatment centers, 8 hospitalized detoxes.
And are you
homeless?
Experiencing this around people you know in Pleasantville?
Yeah. And my mother, like, locked me out of the house, you know, wore her purse around her neck when I was around. Like, I was just a monster.
When would you be able to peek and see yourself that what was happening to you? Did you feel like a stranger in your own life? Like, was there versions of you? I don't know if you've ever experienced this. And
well, this was darkness.
Yeah.
And I've experienced this darkness again. Mm-hmm. I have 2 recovery stories.
Yeah.
And that darkness was just trying to attempt to sleep 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to be comatose, you know. The next darkness, I guess we'll get to that. That one became more violent.
Yeah.
More suicidal.
Yeah. I was scared because I was sober at the time you were struggling. And then after you came back, I lost my mind.
And then the attempts to get sober that time were, we have to get to that because I was just out of my mind. And now I had money.
Yeah. Yeah.
You did. You know, so getting sober when you're 24 and you have nothing, like you can't, you know, $8 an hour, I think I was making here. Like there wasn't.
Yeah.
There was no options to go use drugs.
No. And there's a rush to get away from really awful consequences. You were in a lot of pain.
Yeah. I also had legal problems at 24. Yeah.
In New York?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think I was like the last person to have my parole transferred from New York to Pennsylvania. Like, yeah. And this was before treatment courts, you know, and a lot of that stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah. That wasn't an easy transition back then. What was recovery for you after Serenity Lodge? How did you just get accepted here? How would you describe that? And why did you stay here?
Joe Gilchrist.
Wow. Really? That's right. It's Joe.
Yeah. Joe Gilchrist. So I went to Serenity Lodge and Joe Gilchrist worked there. God bless his soul. And, but I had already had at the Karen Foundation, something happened. I can't tell you what it is. There's like, they call it the turning point. There's like no moment of time when I can tell you that I surrendered. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was because of the withdrawal that I went through or whatever. Something happened down there where I was like, just tell me what to do. I can't do this anymore. And I was just physically beaten up to the point, you know, I had a mitral valve prolapse condition. Like, my heart was in pain, 24 years old, and I'm on beta blockers, you know, because of just being a nut, not being able to sleep. And then, of course, the treatment centers jacked me on psych meds. So I was overweight. Like, I went from, you know, 90 pounds to 180 pounds really fast. It was just a mess.
God. I'm sorry, Joe Gilchrist, you put up.
Yeah. So the man, I walked into the Serenity Lodge and this detestable human being was there. And he gave me a big book. I have it. It says his name is written on the.
Yeah.
It says Joe G. Yeah. And he gave me this. And he said, if you want to live, read this book. And I was like, okay. And the man took me through the big book of Alcoholics
Anonymous. I went through the big book with Joe. Bruce was always my sponsor. But when I came back in 2001, that's how we met right after. Now I could clearly remember. Mm-hmm. Joe Gilchrist was taking me a meeting every day. Yep. Called me every morning. He was relentless. He was tough.
The man.
I love him. Loved him.
And I had other mentors. Like, this is sure. just going to come up That's because, you know, Donnie Callio, yeah, Scotty, Joe Gilchrist, Gene Walsh, like, yeah. Grateful Al.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, Grateful Al, like, gave me an impression. He was so immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless his soul. That man could never drink because of how he went to like 5 meetings a day.
Yeah.
I was like, this guy.
I look back at Al now and I love Al. Just how much trauma I couldn't understand from the context or the lens of my age in my 20s that I thought when I found out how horrifying his experience of Vietnam was. Mm-hmm. Like, I never put that in context because, you know, Al was a character. Everyone was sweet to him. He was young guys, you know, we always got along with them. But to think the horrors that man lived through and how kind and active he was. He was
such a gentle man.
Yeah, he was.
And then to think, like, I had this conversation. He's like, they gave me an
M16. Yeah.
Like,
he's a kid.
He's a child, like a gentle human being, and then they gave him a weapon to go destroy people with. Like, could you imagine?
Yeah, and he wasn't on a base. I mean, he was in horror.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, to think that's the same human being that I would see would dance at the drop of the hat, right. Sing. He was just...
the first meeting I went to at Marworth when I came to Scran, he was chairing.
Yeah.
And then that was like on a Saturday night, and then on Monday night I went to Covenant to the meeting there, and I opened up the 12th and 12 there. And it said Grateful Al, and his phone number was inside the book. I said, I'm going to ask this guy to be my sponsor.
Yeah.
This is the champion of here. I mean, I learned later on.
Yeah, know. Sure. We, you know, we all, A has its own skeletons. We got to protect our own. So there was a really vibrant community and people that really cared about each other. And there was, you know, real recovery.
Well, I watched men who had their lives together. It was almost like they were levitating, dude.
Yeah.
You know, like I watched people come into the room who had a wife and a job and kids, and they would say things to me like, I can't tomorrow. I have to go take my son to Boy Scouts. Like, God, like, that's the life.
Yeah. It was appealing.
Yeah. And then I had other people that just encouraged me to be better. And then I wanted a social life. I wanted to have friends. I wanted to have community. I didn't have, you know, I was isolated. And then the people that I was hanging around with were like, yo, you got to do this stuff or you're not going to be our friend. I'd be like, shit.
And what was the stuff?
Like the work, the, you know, the four step and yeah. stuff like that.
And 7 days a week, every day, did you talk to someone in recovery? Were you going to a meeting? That's what your recovery experience was. Yeah. You were going to meetings, meeting people. And would you call multiple people a day? Touch base.
Oh my God. Right from the gate, I started working on, and I bought my first car in recovery.
Yeah.
$750, Chevy Cavalier. You were in it. I gave you rides in that yeah. car. That's what it was. Like, I put recovery miles on that automobile. Like, it was like every night, like, you want me to pick you up? You know, that was.
When did you feel at home here and you felt safe? That you felt like you were protected from addiction?
It was pretty quick, actually. Yeah, it was fast. It was, it's, I don't sense that in the AA here nowadays. Like, it, COVID hurt some stuff.
It changed. It changes. It'll change back. It could change into something. Changes every 10 years, with or without COVID. COVID made specific changes. I see it coming back now. Recovery Bank helps a lot of that, I think. They're so active. There's daily meetings that are becoming more vibrant. Numbers are going up. But that was damaging. And a lot of people died.
There wasn't even a lot of young people when we first came around here.
We were the young people.
Yeah.
Before you, when I came in 1994 at 16, the next closest guy to my age at that time, before Tom, Mike, anybody, Timmy, was a guy named Dave. Dave was from New York, transplant here. He was 32. And he had like an Air Force fighter pilot jacket, combat boots, like really grunge, but like this wasn't grunge. It was almost like borderline neo-Nazi shit. And Dave was the closest to my age. I saw him at a AA picnic or something. I'm like, this dude's off, man. I was 16 and I knew it. The next week, he stabbed a guy with his own glasses, like almost like a Godfather scene where he broke the guy wouldn't give him his glasses. He was in a psychotic break, schizoaffective, and stabbed the guy with his glasses and ended up in a psych unit, like a state hospital after that. But that was my first experience. This is here's the young people. Dave. His name was Dave.
I felt we bad. Had some great characters though back in the day. Yeah. The Cafe Del Sol, remember that?
Yeah. And there was a cafe just dedicated in Scranton that entire period of time to people in recovery on Mulberry Street. That was banging. So you're sober for a couple of years after this point, after 2000.
Yep.
When did things start to change? Like for the become stale, or maybe you felt restless. What happened?
What was led up to the relapse?
Yeah. So you're sober a while.
11 years.
11 years.
Yeah. And a lot of things were taking place in my life. I'd always been so motivated to figure out like what's my talent to like put everything together into one thing to figure out what it was that I was going to be my career. I'm a talented mechanic.
Yes. Yeah.
And, but I'd always wanted to like, I hated it that they made $98 an hour and gave me 13.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm like, these are even my customers.
Yeah. They were all your customers. I went there all the time. My brother, whole family went there.
Yeah. Everybody.
I said, go see Evan.
Everybody brought, I practiced these principles in all my repairs. I said, like, I just took care of people. And in that case, I always had work, but I wasn't getting a fair break there, you know? And I don't think even if I went to another garage or started my own, it would have just been it's not a good field.
Yeah.
You know, even though I'm still in it, mechanics don't get paid enough. And they're not appreciated sometimes. Yeah. So I bought a house. I ended up with a sober house. Like next thing you know, I had guys living with me. And then I had another sober house. It was very organic, like how my life progressed. And then the guy I was buying tools from, I sold him a roof. Like I was working for a guy on part-time as a roofer.
Wow.
And then I sold my Mac Tools guy a roof. And he's like, how did you do? And it was not just a roof. It turned into a roof, siding, and decks. So it was like $26,000. Wow, like I whacked him, you know? And he's like, how did you do that? Like, why aren't you selling tools? And he's like, come for a ride with me for a day. And just totally recruited me, you know, what do they call it? Headhunted me.
Yeah.
And was like, this kid is too good for this corporation. You know, they lost them.
Yeah, no shit.
And then, but then I started worshiping false gods. This is where it leads up. And the false gods were Benjamin Franklin and Grant.
I just always thought you were money conscious. I didn't see that begin to happen because I come up your house for a picnic. You're having a barbecue. I just saw it flourishing with, you were taking care of a lot of people in the sense of a sponsorship. You're providing a roof for them. You have a nice property. You have a large piece of land. And well, it's always filled with AA people.
It's great that you talked about the parties I had at my house and how I was inclusive and always had lots of people, because that story then turns into, you know, the line of cars outside of my house for the party. And then after I relapsed, the line of cars got smaller and smaller.
Yeah. How about that? I know that.
And that spirals into something. But I think I was trying to provide for this girl that I was married to. And I felt like I had to be, I don't know, maybe it's because I didn't have a dad. Like, it brings up some stuff. Like, I just had a champion this, you know, so maybe she was a little stuck up, you know, and I couldn't satisfy her. So, I don't know. I remodeled the kitchen, you know, I made all this stuff and then the marriage went bad and it slammed me, man.
Yeah.
Slammed me.
Now, were you around people that can understand your pain? Did you feel disconnected from them at this time? Or were you afraid to ask for help? How did that?
Well, I was such a helper.
Yeah,
you were. I had such a hard time
reaching out
for help.
And who would you reach out to?
Exactly.
At that period, you're 11 years sober.
Some people in AA lost credibility because I got to know even people with time. I was like, I can't even talk to this guy.
Yeah, I'm both ends of that. I couldn't talk to anyone, and I was losing credibility.
Right.
I'm sober at the meetings, but, you know, I'm a real jerk, and I don't even know it. Like, yeah, that happens. People don't talk about the
also, serious. She was in AA.
Yeah, that's right.
And so when she started drinking before I did, like, this is what caused the problem, is like, she started drinking and wanted to go hang out with people who weren't in AA now. And I'm like, why aren't my AA friends who are girls that are friends with her, like, jumping on her right now?
Like, it's almost cultish. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, why? Where are you ladies? Like, why aren't you saving my? And I'm going to meetings and I'm saying to myself, I'm different. You know, I'm not like these people. Or I'm also saying to myself, these AAs let me down.
Oh, yeah. It's now
starting to blame. It's almost like my first treatment center. Like, I walked in, this is punishment. These people aren't like me. They don't have my problems.
That's a bad story to tell yourself. You'll get sick. You get real sick.
Yeah.
I know that story.
It was almost like I was living in a world that was color before. Like, I was going on vacations, like New Year's dances. Like, I was a spectacle. My life was amazing. And then all of a sudden, black and white. You know, I'm sitting on my steps at 2 o'clock in the morning in the home I purchased for my wife alone. You know, I think we even had a conversation, me and you.
We did. And I when you said that, I remember it because we were talking, it was late at night and I would stay up late. I think I lived downtown then.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking for a couple weeks and I was a vault because I wasn't like as active in your circle, but we were friends.
Yeah. And I remember what you said to me, actually. I said, you said to me, Evan, you're going to be okay. You're charming. That's what you said to me. I swear to God. And I didn't believe it.
Oh, man.
Or I did believe it, but I was like, still, then why me?
Yeah, that's a lot of pain, man.
Yeah. I was devastated.
You were heartbroken.
Yeah.
And I've been heartbroken. And it's it could be overwhelming. It's hard to talk about, too, when you're an adult man, because you're like, everyone's could experience. If you don't talk about it,
my ex-wife was also from Scranton. Her and her family adopted me.
Yeah.
Also, so I was abandoned there too.
Yeah, it's painful. Does this pain, you didn't find a way to deal with it before? I don't remember. I don't know the details. What was it that brought you right to the moment that you were willing to see if you could drink or.
Well, I had to go get a new wife.
Yeah.
So I went and, you know, found a girl and she wanted to get high. And then it was like, if you can't beat them, join them. You know, I was in love. I didn't want to lose her. You know, and then of course it was sneaky.
Yeah.
You know,
because were you hiding this from people too? Yeah. Like it wasn't an open,
I had commitments, man. I had sponsees.
Oh, that sucks.
So I was like, you know, can I get away with this? Is anyone going to find out? You know, can I keep this a secret? I was asked to speak at the women's meeting at a celebration.
I want to talk about that because there's a sense of you. Like, I remember being resenting that I was hiding drinking from certain people. Mm-hmm. And certain people, I didn't have to. They were my friends.
Right.
Other people, I was afraid. Am I recklessly destroying my reputation? They don't understand.
Oh.
Like, I don't want it to be black and white. He's just an animal now that he drinks. Was there a sense of you that thought you could still hold on to yourself in the relapse? You just can't let other people find out or they're going to make it worse. Isn't that like that story shows?
I would get text messages from guys that I helped get sober. You're letting me down.
Oh, God, man, that's crushing.
Dude.
And
then people who resented me in AA, I got prank phone calls. Swear to God.
Dude. That's gross.
It was disgusting. I even went and fought somebody.
I don't remember. Like, I think it was out of touch. We were out of touch in that period. That's gross.
Somebody who like heard me speak at a meeting that just I rubbed them the wrong way.
Sure.
And I do it. Like, I mean, I have a big, huge ego and condescending.
You're from Pleasantville, man. You're from Pleasantville.
You know, I also, you know, my shoulders are puffed out. Like, you know,
how do you get back from here? Did you think you were going to make it back? Because we ran into each other. How did you get through that?
Well, I went to war.
Yeah.
Like there was 5 years of me.
5 years.
Yeah.
It was 5 years.
Yeah. Trying to, you know, have the best of both worlds. Trying to stay sober or trying to live the AA principled life and then being a double agent. It was working three jobs.
It rips your brain apart.
Oh my God. It was absolutely horrible. And like, this is important. Like I went and did one of those detoxes where they put you under anesthesia.
What is that? I'm not familiar with it.
So I was, you know, they detox you from opiates while you're under anesthesia.
Wow. So there's no conscious experience.
It's not legal in every state. Like, sure. So I went to Detroit and the anesthesiologist gave me anesthesia and then hit me with Narcan.
Yeah.
And then they slowly bring you out of the anesthesia and you wake up with, you know, out of the withdrawal. But trust me, you're still in withdrawal.
Oh, man.
You know, I tried to like just disappear for a week and get sober.
Yeah, I've tried that.
And, you know,
it's
by way of $12,000 detox in Detroit, Michigan.
Oh, God. Evan.
And it was like, oh. That is so painful. Don't ever do that.
Now you have cash flow. You have business. You have a flourishing business. You're your own boss. You have property. How do you keep this stuff going?
I was not keeping it. Like things were bad.
Yeah.
So I always paid my mortgage, but I had a home equity line of credit that I started to default on.
Yeah.
Which was ugly. Not to mention the Pennsylvania Department of Revenue. I'm still paying that one.
So
Mac Tools was coming to scrape the decals off my truck. You know, like it was. But luckily, you know,
what happened?
How did I do it? What's the big comeback?
Yeah, what's the Phoenix?
You ready? Man. So that line of cars that was outside for my parties,
yeah,
that got smaller and smaller and smaller, where people had given up on me. A gentleman by the name of Jeremy Williams, you remember Jeremy?
Yeah, I remember Jeremy. I used to play cards.
They used to call him the Rev.
Yeah,
Reverend Jeremy. He talked about Jesus a lot in meetings.
I like Jeremy. He was a real dude. He was a hard dude.
And we used together.
Yeah.
Jeremy walked in my house and threw my shit away, man. And was like my last hope. And then I came back. This wasn't instantly.
Sure.
I came back. I got another girlfriend. I wasn't focused. I knew how to steal money from my business, mm-hmm. you know, and,
all revenue equals profit.
And, so I, went, what did I do? I think I got in a car and I rented a car from Enterprise and I bought my substance and I drove as far away that the substance would last me for. And I ended up in New Mexico and I detoxed myself with nothing, like with a bad habit, on a bed in a hotel room in New Mexico. I rocked back and forth on the bed so much that my ears were bleeding from the friction of the pillow on my ears.
Was this almost a punishment rather than to accept? What was the resistance to going to a medical detox?
I've been to those places, man.
You're toast.
Yeah. I didn't want to go. I didn't want to be a burden.
And the extremity of extreme drive to New Mexico, is there almost a self-contempt in doing it this way?
I don't know. Like, it was just, you know what? I was high, I was out driving and I'm like, man, I just want to get away. This feels good. I was using
just
like
bang.
The windows open, the warm summer air.
And you just kept going.
And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to rent a car. And I filled the back seat with blankets and pillows. And
I had no idea.
I just drove. People were terrified, dude.
And were you in contact with, like,
there was people like calling me like, where are you? What do you send me a picture of yourself?
That's scary.
Yeah.
If I knew that, I'd be really scared for you.
Yeah. It was nuts. So then I came back from New Mexico and it took me a long ride. It was a quick ride there. It took me like 2 days. The way back took me like I would stop in a hotel for an hour.
It's uphill.
It was a brutal ride. I got a flat tire in the rental car. It was just a mess. And then I came back here. I called my mom. I called a friend in AA, and people kind of surrounded me. And then I knew I was in, this was going to be a long, dangerous road. And I gave Sean Donahue.
Yeah.
I gave him the keys to my car, my quad. I gave him my money. I gave him my credit cards, my driver's license. And I said, don't let me have this.
Wow.
And then one day, and now I'd been, this is really bad. Like, because prior to this, like there was some suicides thinking.
Yeah.
And then the gun, I had guns and I'd put the gun in my mouth. You know, like there was some, this is dark, dark. This is now next level, not 24-year-old kid suicide. This is now I'm ready to like run my car in my garage with the hose type stuff. And one day I asked Sean to come bring me the keys to my car and just give me a couple dollars. And I went to the Old Forge meeting and I was like an hour early and I was real sick. I even crashed my car on the way to the meeting, like just bumped a semi on the way down to 81.
Yeah.
And when I pulled up to the meeting, Sean Bingham's there.
Yeah.
And we weren't like friends.
Sure.
Like we actually hated each other. Like we weren't
okay.
Like we had drama back in the day. And I see Sean across the park and I'm like, is that Sean standing out there? Like he looks so good.
Yeah.
And in the midst of those 5 years of me using, Sean had 5 years sober. And I walked up to him and I lifted up my shirt and I had my gun in my pants. And I said, Sean, I'm ready to kill myself. I need help. And Sean just grabbed me and like, was like, I got you. I'll take care of you. You know?
I love Sean.
And he took my gun.
Yeah. Good. That's pretty smart.
And then I relapsed again. And then Sean got me. Well, then I went to treatment.
Sure.
It was like I went to a real treatment center. And I'm sitting there in the chair, you know, on a Sunday, I got dropped off. And Joe Kane walked up to me. He's like, oh, you came to the Sunday meeting, huh, Evan? And I'm like, no, man. And like, so everybody in this treatment center that I'm at, I helped get sober, bro.
It's a weird place to be.
You know what I mean?
And how did you let go of that? How do you just wash and start new? How do you start over?
I just wanted to stay in bed.
Yeah.
I don't know how I just, Leo helped me a lot with that. Like with just the word new, like in the promises, like he's like, this isn't the recovery when you're 24.
Yeah.
This is a new beginning, a new life, you know?
And you knew you could, did you feel a moment you could start believing that
things maybe were just it is new? So messed up from, well, the house was in foreclosure. They're coming to scrape the decals. My house had frozen. Like the heat was off.
Oh, okay.
So the pipes froze in my house. Total disaster I came home to. And it was February, the end of February. I got sober February.
Out of rehab to a frozen house?
I got sober February 9th, 2015. Yeah. So a month out, like I came out, like you could see I could see my breath in my house. Like I opened up the oven and turned the oven on to heat the house. Sean picked me up from rehab.
Yeah, I don't know how many people that have had the experience of leaving a rehab. You want to go home and chill out. You don't want to turn.
I couldn't even take a shower.
Oh God.
Everything was broken. And like, you know, I called my mom, and my mom's in Al-Anon like 30 years, bro. I was in Karen again, you know, 9-10 years ago. And I called her and asked her for a carton of cigarettes. And she said, no, that would be enabling, and hung up on me. Click. I was like, damn, like black belt Al-Anon status. My mom, she will not do anything unless it's healthy for me.
Yeah. Wow.
So like, I'm not going to call my mom and be like, you know, so, you know, I sat on the hammock, man. I let the business just chill. Oh, and Roy, I can't not have Roy Gogalin in this conversation. Yeah. Roy just opened up that treatment center. I was like one of his first patients.
Yeah, he has I don't know Roy all too well, but I know Sean and Ange, and I love Sean. Bruce was fond of Roy, and that center he's building looks remarkable. Yeah. I mean, just it looks exciting. And he's got a great crew down there, Kyle and all those guys. Kyle helped me a lot when I came back. I didn't know him. He's a fresh face. Mm-hmm. I always enjoyed talking to him. And he was in my home group.
It was just Roy.
Yeah.
When it opened, you know, I was just me and him. Sean made me do it.
Yeah.
And then Roy took me fishing, you know, and was like,
what is with fishing?
Oh, that's just, a whole crew. That's my new thing. That's just my,
was fishing found in this?
No, I fished since I was a kid.
Okay.
You know,
but it looks like there's a group of you, Roy,
Sean fishes, Frank.
Yeah. Is Dave Enslin?
Enslin's incredible fisherman.
You guys have like a fishing club almost, like this non-organized fishing club. It's a little
competitive.
Club. Yeah, all right. But it looks really chill.
That's my church, man.
Yeah?
That's my church.
That's nice. Now, do you keep the fish?
Sometimes. I mean, I don't clean fish. But if I carry him out of the woods, Frank will clean him.
Okay, so he...
Frank's an exceptional cook. Exceptional.
Like, he seems pretty detailed in everything. He's a really interesting guy, and he's extremely bright. Yeah, he's a bright guy. I always liked Frank's company. That was the last time I really sat with Frank was with you. We were down at, I was hatching some scheme for libertarians to do something online. Down at Dunkin' Donuts. Evan, what do you call recovery today? Like what nourishes you? It's 8 years now removed from that pretty dark relapse that in all probability, I think probability is against a person like you or I coming back. because it's so humiliating. Mm-hmm. The depression's so deep. The cynicism that this can work again, it just totally bottoms out. Like, this isn't going to work again. I know I have friends in AA,
right?
But I don't think it's going to work for me. Like, what are they going to stay at my house mm-hmm. until I get better?
Well, there were some, I had to really study my previous recovery.
Yeah.
To see how, what I left out on the fourth step.
Sure.
Then, to make this new recovery. So some of those things were self-care. Not being able to say, no, I can't. I got to do what I got to do right now. Roy really helped me with meditation, like yeah. improving that consciousness. But it's just about really just being still and prioritizing peace. Like going outside without the phone and anything and just listening. Like if I can hear the highway, you know, through the forest, you know, what sounds are available.
Experience. You're experiencing real time.
Yes. Your body. My breathing, you know, what is going on?
Why does that work?
Why does it work? I don't know.
I think I have a clue. Like,
but how it works is it's just gets me grounded in a way.
Yeah. It stops noise.
Yeah. Like
we share a common word, resentment. To refeel, similar to rumination. Most people have this problem. Their brain is lost in thought. Mm-hmm. But with alcoholism, it's so severe. And it's usually a story of just so unmeasured of you being a victim. A plot has been hatched against you. Your life has been, there's a life you should have had and it's been taken from you.
Right.
And everything else you have isn't enough.
But hanging on to the resentment.
This is a story you got to tell all the time.
Hanging on to that. Is also my ego
yeah.
not letting that go. And so I try to transcend that. Like the work day, I have a hectic work day. I have a hectic business. It's very stressful sometimes. But it's I can turn it into a vacation now. I couldn't do that before.
Yeah. How do you describe that? So you could turn it into a vacation. If I'm hearing you right, you can find peace within it.
Absolutely.
That's it.
It's amazing.
How do you, so that's the fishing, self-care, saying no.
Yeah. Even being able to just go, wow, this is absolutely insane. What's going on right now in my life and in my head and just going, wow, let's just get rid of that. Let's just laugh that off. And move away from that. Nothing is not, everything's solvable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And sometimes the things that are not solvable, don't touch it.
Yeah.
Do nothing. Sometimes the best thing to do is absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
It's okay. I used to tell myself, like, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be like, as soon as I open my eyes, I got to get this done. Do this, this, this. How about don't go to work? And don't feel bad about it. I would have guilt if I took the day off to go fishing before. You know, now I'm like, I deserve it. I earned it. Stop being so hard on yourself.
I don't know. There's a spirituality to that. And the perspective, your fishing trips are finite. So is work. Like, do you want to be in a deficit for fishing trips? When life ends? I don't think so.
Well, I have to make money to afford
you do,
to fish.
But like there's a perspective that like if you're caught in all those problems one morning, I got to get this done. Mm-hmm. I know that and I need that in my life. Some days need you to pause so you can really, you don't break a gasket. Like,
yeah.
Like what am I trying to
and
achieve?
And then if I don't want to make fishing work too.
No.
You know what I mean? So that's the reward. It's just a flow. It is.
So key facts, you saved your business. You saved your house.
Big time. Oh, and then I've grown my business also.
Yeah, absolutely.
Time. So a friend of mine now was laid off. And one day he sits in my tool truck next to me and goes, I'm coming to work with you. I'm collecting unemployment. And he's getting sober too.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know? And I'm like, all right, dude. Sure. So I'm driving the truck and he's next to me. And then one day I'm like, you drive. you know? So then he's sitting in the driver's seat and I'm in the passenger seat working deals, figuring stuff out, numbers and stuff. A couple months later, I'm like, I'm going on vacation. I'm going to go to Florida for a week. He goes, I'll run your route while you're gone. I was paying him pennies, like just to hang out with me. And he was kind of my inspiration to go to work every day. So I go to Florida and I'm sitting on the beach. Oh, I wanted to sell my business at that time too.
Yeah.
And the guy was looking at buying a one truck operation.
I remember that. I ran into you.
And he's like, well, how long before I can have multi-route? And I'm like, you have to get approved. So I'm sitting at the beach and my phone is dinging on the beach and it's credit card transactions that Ricky's doing while I'm on vacation. And I'm like, is this happening right now? He's making me money. So I came back and I'm like, hey, I said to the guy, I'm like, you want to buy my business? I'll multi-route it. Then you can buy it. And he goes, oh, cool. Do that. I went and bought another truck, filled it with, I had so much inventory. I filled the other truck with tools, sent Ricky on his way. And then I came back to the guy and I said, well, now it's more money. And I scared him away.
He
didn't want the business anymore. But now here we are, like, you know.
It's still flowing.
Evan Glass, Mac Tools, platinum distributor.
Listen, I go over to my brother Patrick's house. The garage only exists to house your product. Like, he bought everything I think you've ever sold. Well, Evan, I'm really glad you said yes to this. I usually hit an hour and we're here. It's strange. I sit here amongst people. I'll be at a meeting now. I'm 45. And like I described how long I knew you. And this is it. These are the people in my life. Like, there's nothing else happened. There's no other people coming. And you said something earlier during this that just put me at pause, that this is my life. This is what's happening. Yeah. I want to be a part of it. I want to be present. I don't want to be living the life that's happening in my head. This is killing me. You hit that home with the fishing and other things you were describing. This is it. You are the people in my life. I have a very extended AA or 12-step family. How do people make it without it? It's just phenomenal.
this is my community. I grew up here, you know?
Yeah.
And because of that, I'll take care of it.
Well, I want to thank you again. I'm glad you came on.
It was fun.
All right, brother. Talk to you soon.
Yep.
I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. To find us on allbetter.fm or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right.
Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.